Or what, among the common preconceptions about the gods, has been more universally proclaimed than sayings such as, "The blessed gods take their delight all their days," and, "Of the immortal gods and of men who walk the earth." And, "For those gods are free from sickness and old age and untouched by toil, having escaped the deep-roaring stream of Acheron." One might perhaps find barbarian and savage peoples who have no conception of God at all, but no human being has ever existed who, while conceiving of a God, conceived him as neither indestructible nor eternal. At any rate, those called atheists, the Theodoruses, the Diagoreses, the Hippos, did not dare say that the divine is perishable. Rather, they simply did not believe that anything indestructible exists, without thereby abandoning the notion of the indestructible as such while withholding the preconception of God. But Chrysippus and Cleanthes, having filled, one might almost say, heaven, earth, air, and sea with gods by their reasoning, have left not one of all these as indestructible or eternal, except Zeus alone, into whom they make all the others dissolve away, so that even he has no advantage over them in the matter of destroying rather than being destroyed. For it is a form of weakness both when a thing is destroyed by changing into something else, and when a thing is preserved only by feeding on other things as they are destroyed into it. And these are not conclusions we draw, as with many other absurdities of theirs, merely from their premises by following out their doctrines. No, they themselves, shouting it aloud in their own treatises on the gods, on providence, on fate, and on nature, say explicitly that all the other gods have come into being and will be destroyed by fire, being, according to them, fusible like figures of wax or tin. It is therefore contrary to the common conception, on a par with saying that a man is immortal, to say that a god is mortal. Or rather, I do not see what difference there will be left between God and man, if God too is a rational and destructible living being. Or if, in turn, they set up this clever and elegant distinction, that man is mortal, but God is not mortal, only destructible, look what follows for them. Either they will have to say that God is at once immortal and destructible, or that he is neither mortal nor immortal. And there is no way, even for people deliberately inventing paradoxes, to surpass this absurdity, I mean other people. Since for these men nothing among the most absurd things has been left unsaid or untried. Further, Cleanthes, straining to defend the conflagration, says that the moon and the rest of the stars make the sun assimilate everything to itself and change it into itself. But if the stars, being gods, cooperate toward their own destruction, cooperating with the sun, contributing something to the general conflagration, it would be a great absurdity for us to pray to them for our safety and to regard them as saviors of men, when it is in accordance with their own nature to hasten toward their own destruction and annihilation. And indeed, they themselves leave nothing undone in their attacks on Epicurus, crying, "Alas, alas! Woe, woe!" As though he were confounding the preconception of the gods by doing away with providence. For it is preconceived and understood, they say, that God is not only immortal and blessed, but also benevolent toward mankind, solicitous and beneficial. Which is true. But if those who do not abandon providence are, on their view, doing away with the preconception about God, what are we to say of those who claim that the gods exercise providence over us but do not benefit us, and are not givers of good things, but of things indifferent, not giving virtue, but giving wealth and health, and the begetting of children, and such things, none of which is beneficial or profitable or choiceworthy or advantageous? Is it not rather that the Epicureans do not abolish the conceptions about the gods, while these men both insult and mock them, calling one a god, giver of fruits, another giver of birth, another healer, another giver of oracles, when health and birth and abundance of fruit are, on their own view, not good things at all, but things indifferent and unprofitable to those who receive them? The third element, then, of the conception of the gods is that the gods differ from men in nothing so much as in happiness and virtue. But according to Chrysippus, not even this is left to them. For Zeus does not surpass Dion in virtue, and Zeus and Dion, both being wise, are benefited equally by one another whenever the one happens to be in motion while the other. For this, they say, is precisely what constitutes the good that passes from gods to men and from men to gods, the motion of a wise man, and nothing else. And they say that a man who falls short of virtue in nothing lacks nothing of happiness either, but that even the unfortunate man is equally blessed with Zeus the Savior, even one who, on account of diseases and bodily mutilations, takes himself out of life by his own hand, provided only that he is wise. But such a man exists nowhere on earth, nor has he ever existed. While countless myriads of men live in the depths of misery under the very government and rule of Zeus, which is said to administer all things in the best possible way. And yet, what could be more contrary to the common conception than that, while Zeus administers in the best possible way, we should fare in the worst possible way? At any rate, if, what it is not even permitted to say, he should wish to be neither savior, nor gentle, nor averter of evil, but the very opposite of these fine titles, there would be nothing left to add to the sum of existing evils, either in number or in magnitude, according to what these men themselves say. Since all men already live in the extreme of wretchedness and misery, and evil admits of no further increase, nor unhappiness of any further excess. And yet this is not the most terrible part of it. Rather, whereas Menander, speaking in the manner of the stage, said, "The greatest source of evils among men is that they chafe at having too much good." And this, they say, is contrary to the common conception. They themselves make God, who is good, the very source of evils. For matter itself did not furnish evil out of itself, they say, since it is without quality and has received all the differentiations it possesses from that which moves and shapes it. But it is reason, indwelling in matter, that moves and shapes it, matter itself being by nature incapable of moving or shaping itself. It follows, then, of necessity, that evil, if it comes from nothing, comes from what does not exist. But if it comes through the moving principle, it must exist as having come to be from God. And indeed, if they suppose that Zeus does not have mastery over his own parts, nor employs each of them according to his own reason. That too is contrary to the common conception, and amounts to imagining a living creature, many of whose parts escape its will, exercising their own private activities and actions, to which the whole gives no impulse and does not initiate the motion. For nothing possessed of soul is so badly put together that, against its will, its feet move forward, or its tongue speaks, or its horn butts, or its teeth bite. And most of these things God would necessarily have to suffer, if the wicked, being parts of him, lie and act unscrupulously, and break into houses, and murder one another against his will. But if, as Chrysippus says, it is not possible for even the smallest of his parts to be disposed otherwise than according to the will of Zeus, but every ensouled thing is by nature so constituted and so moved as he leads it, and he turns it, and he restrains it, and he arranges it, then this doctrine of his own is even more outrageous. For it would be countless times more reasonable that his parts, forced by some weakness and incapacity on the part of Zeus, should do many things contrary to his nature and will, than that there should be neither lack of self-control nor wrongdoing at all, of which Zeus is not the cause. But indeed, that the universe is a city, and the stars its citizens, and if this is so, then obviously also tribesmen and magistrates, and the sun a counselor, and the evening star a president or a market overseer. I do not know whether those who refute such notions do not thereby show themselves more absurd than the very people who propound and assert them. But among the more physical of their doctrines, is it not contrary to the common conception that a seed should be greater and more than what is generated from it? At any rate, we observe that nature, in every kind of animal and plant, both tame and wild, takes as the starting points for the generation of the greatest things. Things that are small, meager, and scarcely visible. For not only does an ear of wheat come from a grain of wheat, or a vine from a single grape seed, but from the stone of some acorn that a bird has let slip, kindling and fanning its growth. As it were, from some tiny spark, there springs up a shoot of bramble, or oak, or palm, or pine, that grows to an enormous height. And they say, the term seed sperma is named from the sowing sparing of a small mass out of a larger one, while nature physis is a kind of inflation emphyses and diffusion of the rational principles or numbers that are being opened up and released by it. But again, in the case of the universe, the fire which they call its seed, after the conflagration, changed the world into seed from a smaller body and mass, though possessing a great nature and taking in addition, for its growth, an immense region of the void spreading out around it. While when it is generated once more, its magnitude withdraws and shrinks together again, as matter contracts and gathers itself back into itself in the process of generation. One can hear them, and meet with many of their writings, disputing against the academics and crying out that they confound everything by their doctrine of the indistinguishables, forcing upon two distinct substances a single qualified thing. And yet there is no human being who does not think this way already, and who, on the contrary, would not consider it astonishing and paradoxical if it turned out that, in the whole of time, no dove has ever been indistinguishable from another dove, nor bee from bee, nor grain of wheat from grain of wheat, or, as the saying goes, fig from fig. It is, rather, the things these men themselves say and imagine that are truly contrary to the common conception, namely, that upon a single substance two individually qualified things should come to be, and that the same substance, while possessing one particular quality of its own, should, when another quality supervenes upon it, receive that quality too and preserve both alike. For if two, then there will also be three, and four, and five, and as many as one could not even number, subsisting about a single substance. I mean not distributed among different parts, but all of them alike pervading the whole, infinite in number. At any rate, Chrysippus says, Zeus is like a man, and the universe is like Zeus, while providence is like the soul. So that, when the conflagration occurs, Zeus, being the only one of the gods who is indestructible, withdraws into providence. And then, the two having become one, they continue together thereafter within the single substance of the ether. Having then now dismissed the gods, and having prayed that they grant us common sense and a common mind, let us see how matters stand for them regarding the elements. It is contrary to the common conception that body should be the place of another body, and that body should pass through body, with neither containing any void, but the full entering into the full, and receiving what is mixed into it, though it has no interval and no room within itself, owing to its own continuity. But these men do not merely press one thing into another, or two, or three, or ten. Rather, once the world has been divided up into all its parts, they throw all of them together into any one thing that happens along. And, while claiming that the smallest perceptible particle will run short when the largest thing enters into it, they play the reckless young hothead, turning their own refutation into a dogma, as in many other cases, since they are forever adopting hypotheses that fight against the common conceptions. For instance, by this very argument, those who mix whole bodies with whole bodies must accept many monstrous and bizarre consequences. Among these is the claim that three is four. For other people cite this as an extreme example of the unthinkable, but for these men it actually follows that when one ladleful of wine is mixed with two ladlefuls of water, if it is not to fall short but to become equal to them, then, by spreading itself throughout and thoroughly commingling, the one that is one becomes two, through the equalizing of the mixture with the two, for to remain one, and yet to extend over two, and to make itself equal to the double, is absurd. Further, in order that it may, through the mixture, reach as far as the two, it must take on a twofold measure in the diffusion, and this same measure is at once the measure both of three and of four. Of three, because to the two, one has been mixed in. Of four, because, having been mixed with the two, it has come to possess a quantity equal to that with which it is mixed. This, then, is the fine result that comes about for them when they throw bodies into bodies, and the very notion of containing becomes unthinkable as well. For it is necessary, when things pass into one another through mixing, that it not be the case that the one contains while the other is contained, and that the one receives while the other is received within it. For in that case, there would be no blending at all, but only contact and mere touching of surfaces, with the one slipping in beneath and the other containing it from outside, while all the other parts remain unmixed and pure, kept apart from one another. But it is necessary, if the commingling occurs as they claim, that the things mixed together become, in and among one another, one and the same thing at once, by being contained through being within, and by containing through receiving the other. And yet it is impossible for either of them again to be so. And yet both must occur, since the mixture forces its way through both alike, leaving no part of either unfilled, but rather filling everything completely with everything. At this point, no doubt, comes in, trampling with laughter on their absurdities, the famous leg bandied about in the lecture halls of Arcesilaus. For if blendings occur throughout entire holes, what prevents? Once a leg has been cut off, and has rotted and been thrown into the sea, and dissolved, not merely the fleet of Antigonus from sailing straight through it, as Arcesilaus used to say, but the 1,200 ships of Xerxes, together with the 300 Greek triremes, from fighting a sea battle all within that leg. For surely, as it proceeds, the mixture will not run short, nor will it stop or come to a limit while the lesser is contained within the greater. Nor will its final extent, wherever it stops, having made contact, fail to pervade the whole. Rather, it will refuse to mix any further. But if it is indeed to be mixed throughout the whole, then, by Zeus, the leg will hardly provide the Greeks a place to fight their sea battle. No, this would require putrefaction and transformation first. A single ladleful, or even a single drop, falling straight from that spot into the Aegean Sea or the Cretan Sea, will reach all the way to the ocean and the Atlantic Sea, touching it not merely on the surface, but spreading everywhere through its depth, in breadth and length together. And these very consequences Chrysippus himself accepts, right at the start of the first book of his Physical Questions. Nothing, saying that it lacks nothing, a single drop of wine mixes with the sea. And so that we should not marvel even at this, he says that the drop extends its blending through the entire cosmos. I do not know what could be found more absurd than this. Moreover, it is contrary to our common conception that there is, among bodies in nature, neither an extreme, nor a first, nor a last part, nothing at which the magnitude of a body comes to an end, but that always something appears beyond whatever has been taken, so that the subject casts itself into the infinite and indeterminate. For it will not be possible to conceive one magnitude as greater or less than another, if progression to infinity by parts happens to both alike. Rather, the very nature of inequality is abolished. For when unequal things are conceived, the one falls short in its outermost parts while the other exceeds and surpasses it. But if there is no inequality, it follows that there is neither unevenness nor roughness in a body. For unevenness is the inequality of a single surface relative to itself, and roughness is unevenness combined with hardness. Yet those who carry bodies through to a final part leave out none of this, while those who extend everything to infinity by a multitude of parts abolish it all. And yet, how is it not evident that a man is composed of more parts than a man's finger, and again, that the cosmos is composed of more parts than a man? These things everyone understands and thinks, unless they become Stoics. But once they become Stoics, they say, and hold the opposite, namely that a man is not composed of more parts than a finger, nor the cosmos of more parts than a man, since the division of bodies proceeds to infinity, and among infinities none is greater or less, nor does any quantity exceed another at all, or else the parts of what remains will stop being divided and yielding any quantity out of themselves. How then do they ward off these difficulties? Most resourcefully and boldly indeed. For Chrysippus says, when we are asked whether we have parts and how many, and out of what and how many parts each of those is composed, we shall employ a distinction, positing the general answer, that we are composed of head and chest and legs. For this was the whole of what was being asked and raised as a puzzle. But if they press the questioning on to the ultimate parts, he says, none of these things is to be assumed. Rather, one must say that we are composed neither out of certain parts, nor out of any number whatsoever, nor out of infinite parts, nor out of finite parts. And I think it worth using his very own words, so that you may see the manner in which he kept guarding the common conceptions, bidding us to conceive of each of bodies as composed neither out of certain parts, nor out of any number of parts, nor out of infinite parts, nor out of finite parts. For if, just as the indifferent is a mean between good and bad, so too there is something intermediate between the finite and the infinite, he ought to have said what this is, and so resolved the difficulty. But if, as the unequal is at once the not equal, and the imperishable the not perishable, so we are to conceive the infinite as the not finite, then this is, I think, similar to saying that a body is neither out of finite nor out of infinite parts, and that an argument is neither out of true premises nor out of false ones nor out of. And on top of this, indulging in a bit of youthful bravado, he says, "Since a pyramid is composed of triangles, the sides that incline together at the point of contact are unequal, yet not exceeding one another in that they are greater." This is how he kept guard over the common conceptions. For if there is something greater that does not exceed, there will be something smaller that does not fall short, so that the unequal neither exceeds nor falls short. That is, the unequal is equal, and the greater is not greater, nor the smaller smaller. Further, then, observe in what manner he met Democritus, who raised a natural and apt puzzle. If a cone is cut by a plane parallel to the base, what should we think about the surfaces of the sections? Are they equal or unequal? For if unequal, they will make the cone uneven, taking on many step-like notches and roughnesses. But if equal, the sections will be equal, and the cone will appear to have the property of a cylinder, being composed of equal and not unequal circles, which is most absurd. At this point, declaring Democritus ignorant, he says, "The surfaces are neither equal nor unequal, but the bodies are unequal because their surfaces are neither equal nor unequal." To legislate that, the surfaces being neither equal nor unequal, it follows that the bodies are unequal, is to grant oneself a marvelous license to write whatever comes to mind. For, on the contrary, reason together with plain evidence allows us to conceive that of unequal bodies the surfaces are unequal, and that the surface of the greater is greater, since, unless the excess is to be deprived of surface, the greater must have it. For if the surfaces of the greater bodies do not exceed those of the lesser, but instead fall short of them, there will be a part of a body having a limit that itself has no limit and is unbounded. For if he says that, since the notches he suspects around the cone are being forced upon us in this way, it is the inequality of the bodies, not that of the surfaces, that produces them, that is absurd. To remove the surfaces from consideration and yet leave the unevenness that was being contested still present within the bodies. But even if we stay with his hypothesis, what is more contrary to the common conception than to fabricate such things? For if we shall posit that one surface is neither equal nor unequal to another surface, then we shall also have to say that one magnitude is neither equal nor unequal to another magnitude, and one number neither equal nor unequal to another number, being some mean between the equal and the unequal that is neither of the two, something they cannot state nor even conceive. Further, if surfaces exist that are neither equal nor unequal, what prevents circles too from being conceived as neither equal nor unequal? For the very surfaces of the conic sections are of course circles. And if circles, then the diameters of circles too must be posited as neither equal nor unequal. And if this, then angles and triangles and parallelograms and parallelepipeds and solids as well. And indeed, if there are lengths that are neither equal nor unequal to one another, then there will also be weight and impact, and bodies of that kind. Then how do they dare to censure those who introduce voids and certain partless entities that fight against the possibility of either moving or remaining at rest, while they themselves call such assertions false? If certain things are not equal to one another, those things are unequal to one another. And these things, while not equal to one another, are not unequal to one another either. Since he says there is something greater that does not exceed, it is worth asking whether such things will coincide with one another. For if they will coincide, how is the one greater than the other? And if they will not coincide, how is it not necessary that the one exceed and the other fall short? And yet, for it to have neither, neither to fail to coincide because it is greater, nor to coincide because it is not greater, is impossible for one of the two to hold. For necessity compels those who do not safeguard the common conceptions into just such difficulties as these. Furthermore, it is contrary to the common conception that nothing touches anything at all, and no less contrary to it is this, that bodies touch one another yet touch nothing. But this latter is what those who leave no least parts of a body are compelled to accept, since they always take some further point beyond what seemed to be the point of contact, and never stop advancing beyond it. Indeed, the very argument that they themselves most often bring against those who champion partless entities is this, that there is neither contact of wholes with wholes nor of parts with parts, for the former produces not contact but blending, and the latter is not possible, since partless things have no parts. How, then, do they not fall into the very same difficulty themselves, since they leave no part that is last or first? Because by Zeus, they say, bodies touch at a limit, not as holes touching holes, nor as parts touching parts, and the limit is not itself a body. So then body will touch body by means of something incorporeal, and again it will not touch it, since something incorporeal lies between. But if it does touch, then the body will both act upon and be acted upon by the incorporeal. For it is the nature of bodies to act and be acted upon by one another, and to touch, through mutual contact. And if a body has contact with something incorporeal, it will also have union with it, and blending, and organic growth. Further, in cases of union and blending, either the limits of the bodies must remain, or they must not remain but be destroyed. Either alternative is contrary to the common conception, for they themselves do not allow that incorporeal things come to be or perish. Yet a blending and union of bodies that each retain their own limits could not occur, for the limit defines and fixes the nature of the body. Whereas blendings, unless they are juxtapositions of part alongside part, but rather cases where the things mixed pour together whole with whole, as these men say, require us to grant that the limits perish in the mixtures and then come to be again when the bodies separate, and no one could easily conceive of that. But indeed, precisely where bodies touch one another, at that very point they also press and squeeze and crush one another, and it is not possible for incorporeal things to undergo or produce such effects. Indeed, it is not even conceivable. Yet this is what they force us to think. For if a sphere touches a plane at a point, clearly it also drags along the point across the plane as it moves, and if it has been smeared with red ochre on its surface, it will leave a red ochre line upon the plane, and if it has been heated red hot, it will heat the plane red hot too. But that a body should be colored by something incorporeal or heated by something incorporeal is contrary to the common conception. And if we imagine an earthenware or crystal sphere borne from a height onto a stone pavement, it would be unreasonable for it not to be shattered, given the impact against a resisting surface. And it is still more absurd that it should be shattered at a limit and point that is incorporeal when it strikes. So that in every way their preconceptions concerning incorporeal things and bodies are thrown into confusion, or rather utterly destroyed, as they set forth many impossibilities. It is contrary to the common conception to say that there is a time that is future and a time that is past, but that there is no present time. Rather, that the recent and the just now have subsistence, while the now is nothing at all. And yet this is exactly what happens to the Stoics, who leave no least time and yet do not want the now to be partless. Instead, whatever one takes and thinks of as present, they claim that part of it is future and part past, so that nothing at all remains as present and no portion of time is left over as now. Rather, of the time said to be present, part is distributed to the future and part to the past. One of two things follows then. Either by positing there was time and there will be time, they abolish there is time. Or else there is a present time, part of which has already begun and part of which will begin, and one must say that of what exists, part is future and part past, and of the now, part is earlier and part later. So that what is now is what is not yet now and what is no longer now, since the past is no longer now, and the future is not yet now. And necessarily, dividing things this way, they must say that of today part is yesterday and part tomorrow, and of this year part is last year and part next year, and of, at the same time, part is earlier and part later. For they muddle these no less, doing the very same thing with not yet, and already, and no longer, and now, and not now, whereas all other people posit and conceive and believe that just now and in a little while are different portions from the now, placing the one after the now and the other before it. Of these are Chedemus, saying that the now is a certain starting point and joining place of the past and the coming time, has, it seems, without realizing it, abolished time altogether. For if the now is not time, but a limit of time, and every portion of time is of the same kind as the now, then the whole of time turns out to have no parts at all, but is resolved entirely into limits and joining points and impulses. Chrysippus, wishing to be clever about the division, in his work on the void and in certain others says that the past and future portions of time do not exist, but merely subsist, and that only the present exists. Yet in the third and fourth and fifth books on parts, he holds that, of the present time, part is future and part past. So it turns out that he divides what exists in his own account into things that do not exist, or rather, that he leaves nothing at all of time as existing, if the present has no part that is not either future or past. Their conception of time, then, is like grasping at water. The more tightly it is squeezed, the more it runs through and slips away. And their account of actions and motions carries the same utter confusion of plain evidence. For it is necessary, if of the now part is divided off into the past and part into the future, and of what is in motion at the now part has already moved and part is going to move, that the limit and starting point of motion be abolished. And that of no deed has anything ever been first, nor will anything be last, since deeds are distributed along with time. For just as they say that of the present time part is already past, and part is going to be, so too of what is being done, part has already been done and part will be done. When, then, did eating breakfast, or writing, or walking begin, and when will it end, if everyone who breakfasts has breakfasted and will breakfast, and everyone who walks has walked and will walk? But the most terrible of terrible things, they say, is that if for the one who is alive, having lived and being going to live both apply, then living has neither had a beginning nor will have an end. Rather, each of us, it seems, has come to be without having begun to live, and will die without having ceased. For if there is no last part, but always some part of what is present for the living passes over into the future, then the statement, Socrates will live, never becomes false. Rather, for as long as Socrates is living is true, for just as long Socrates has died is false, so that, if Socrates will live is true in infinitely many parts of time, in no part of time will Socrates has died be true. And yet what limit could there be to a deed? Where could that which is being done ever come to an end, if, as many times as it is being done is true, just so many times it will be done is also true? For the one speaking of Plato as writing and conversing will be lying, that Plato will at some time stop conversing, if it is never false to say, he will converse of one who is conversing, and he will write of one who is writing. Furthermore, there is no part of what is coming to be that is not either already come to be or about to come to be. That is, either past or future. But there is no perception of what has come to be, of what is past, or of what is future. Therefore, there is, absolutely, perception of nothing. For we neither see nor hear the past or the future, nor do we get any other perception of things that have happened or are going to happen. So nothing is perceptible, even if something is present, if of the present one part is always still future and another already past, one part already come to be and another still going to come to be. And yet these same men say that Epicurus does outrageous things and does violence to our common notions, in making bodies move at equal speed and allowing nothing to be swifter than anything else. But far more outrageous than this, and far more removed from our common notions, is the claim that nothing can ever be overtaken by anything else, not even if, as the saying goes, the swift horse of Adrastus should pursue the tortoise from behind. Yet this must follow, if things move according to a before and an after, while the distances they traverse are divisible to infinity, as these men maintain. For if the tortoise had only 100-foot head start on the horse, those who cut this distance to infinity, while making both move according to a before and an after, will never bring the fastest thing up to the slowest, since the slower always keeps some interval ahead, an interval divisible into infinite intervals. And how is it not contrary to common notion that water poured out of a bowl or cup should never be entirely poured out? Or how does this not follow from what these men say? For no one could conceive of a motion proceeding, according to a before, through things divisible to infinity, as ever completing the whole. Rather, since it always leaves some divisible remainder, it will render every pouring out, every trickling and flowing of liquid, every movement of a solid, and every fall of a released weight, incomplete. I pass over many of their absurdities, touching only on those that run contrary to common notion. Now the argument concerning growth is an old one. It was posed, as Chrysippus says, by Epicharmus. But when the members of the academy held that the puzzle was not at all easy or ready to hand, these men loudly denounced them on many counts, as though they were doing away with our preconceptions and holding views contrary to our common notions, indeed, as even perverting our very perception. For the argument is a simple one, and these men themselves grant its premises, that all particular substances flow and are in motion, releasing some things from themselves and receiving others that come upon them from elsewhere, and that the things to which additions and subtractions accrue in number or in quantity do not remain the same, but become different through the aforesaid accretions, since their substance undergoes alteration. And that these changes are called growth and decline, not rightly, but by the prevailing force of custom, whereas it would be more fitting to call them comings to be and perishings, because they carry what exists out of its established state into something else, whereas growing and diminishing are properly affections of a body that underlies and persists. Now, when these things are said and laid down in this way, what do these self-appointed champions of clarity and canons of common notion go on to demand? That each of us is twin, of double nature, and twofold, not as the poets made the sons of Moliene, joined in some parts and separate in others, but two bodies having the same color, the same shape, the same weight and place, never before seen by any human being. Yet these men alone have discerned this compounding, doubling, and ambiguity, that each of us is really two underlying substrata, the one substance and the other quality. The one is ever flowing and in motion, neither growing nor diminishing, nor remaining in any way as it is. The other remains and grows and diminishes, and undergoes in every respect the opposite of the first, yet grown together, fitted together, and fused with it, so that it nowhere allows perception to grasp the difference. And yet the famous Lynceus is said to have seen through rock and through oak, and someone sitting on a watchtower in Sicily could see the Carthaginian ships sailing out of harbor, a day and a night sail away. And Callicrates and Miamesides, they say, fashioned chariots covered by the wings of a fly and engraved verses of Homer, in letters, upon a sesame seed. Yet this otherness and difference within us no one has ever discerned or distinguished. Nor have we ourselves perceived that we have become double, flowing in one part, while in the other remaining the same from birth until death. I am putting the argument more simply than it stands, since they actually make four substrata for each thing, or rather, four for each one of us. But even the two are enough to show the absurdity, if indeed, when we hear Pentheus in the tragedy saying that he sees two suns and Thebes doubled, we say that he is not seeing but hallucinating, deranged and disturbed in his reasoning. While we do not dismiss these men, who set down not one city but all men, all animals, all trees, all implements, tools, and garments as double and of double nature, as forcing us to be deranged rather than to understand. Here, then, perhaps they should be forgiven for inventing different natures of underlying things, since no other device seems available to men eager to preserve and safeguard the phenomenon of growth. But in the case of the soul, what has come over them, or what other assumptions are they dressing up, that they manufacture differences and forms of bodies well nigh infinite in number, one could not say, except that, banishing our common and familiar notions, or rather doing away with and destroying them altogether, they bring in others, strange and alien. For it is thoroughly absurd, having made the virtues and vices, and besides these all the arts and all the memories, and further the impressions, passions, impulses, and ascents, into bodies, then to say that they occupy no place and that there is no room to hold them, but to leave a single point-sized passage in the heart, where they confine the ruling faculty of the soul. Occupied by so many bodies that their sheer multitude escapes even those who claim to be quite capable of marking off and distinguishing one from another. And to make these not merely bodies, but rational living creatures, and a swarm of so many creatures neither friendly nor tame, but a hostile mob arrayed against the vices and possessed of a warlike mind. To declare that each of us is a park, or a pen, or a wooden horse. What could one even think to call these fabrications of theirs? It is a kind of extreme contempt and lawlessness toward what is self-evident and toward ordinary usage. And they say not only that the virtues and vices are living creatures, nor only that the passions, anger, envy, grief, malicious joy, are nor only that graspings, impressions, and states of ignorance are, nor that the arts, cobblery, bronze working are living creatures. But beyond all this, they even make the very activities into bodies and living creatures. walking a living creature, dancing, putting on shoes, addressing someone, abusing someone. And it follows from this that laughter too is a living creature, and weeping. And if these, then also coughing, sneezing, groaning, spitting altogether, and nose blowing, and the rest, for these consequences are obvious. And let them not be annoyed at being led to these conclusions by an argument proceeding step by step, remembering that Chrysippus himself, in the first book of his Physical Questions, argues in just this fashion. It is not the case that night is a body while evening and dawn and midnight are not bodies, nor that day is a body while the new moon is not also a body, and the 10th, and the 15th, and the 30th of the month. The month too is a body, and summer, and autumn, and the year. But while these claims do violence to our common preconceptions, the following do violence even to their own private ones. They generate the hottest thing by cooling, and the finest grain thing by condensation. For the soul, presumably, is the hottest and finest grained of things, yet they produce it by the cooling and condensation of the body, as though by a kind of tempering, the breath changing from vegetative into psychic. They also say that the sun has come to be ensouled, moisture changing into intelligent fire. It is high time, then, that the sun too should be thought to be generated by cooling. Xenophanes, indeed, when someone told him he had seen eels living in hot water, said, "Well then, we shall boil them in cold water." The same consequence would follow for them. If they generate the hottest things by cooling and the lightest things by condensation, then, in turn, they should generate cold things by heat, dense things by dispersal, and heavy things by separation, thereby preserving a kind of consistency in their inconsistency. And do they not also posit the very substance and origin of the notion, itself contrary to our common notions? For a notion is a kind of impression, and an impression is an imprinting upon the soul. But the soul's nature is exhalation, which is difficult to imprint at all, owing to its rarity, and which, even if it does receive an imprint, is incapable of retaining it. For its nourishment and its very generation, being from moist matter, involve a continuous inflow and expenditure. And its intermixture with the air through breathing constantly produces a fresh exhalation, one that is displaced and altered by the channel that pours in from outside and again flows out. For one could more readily conceive of a flowing stream of water preserving shapes, imprints, and forms than of a breath moving amid vapors and moist exhalations, continually being mixed from outside with another breath that is, as it were, inert and alien to it. Yet so thoroughly do they misconstrue their own doctrine that they define notions as certain stored-up conceptions, memories as fixed and retained imprints, and knowledge as something altogether solidified, possessing what is unchanging and secure. And then they go on to posit as the base and seat of these things a substance that is slippery, scattering, ever in motion, and flowing. As for the notion of an element and a first principle, it is, one might say, innate and common to all human beings that it should be simple, unmixed, and uncompounded. For what is compounded is not an element or a first principle, but rather the things out of which it is compounded are. And yet these men, in making God, who is a first principle, an intelligent body and an intellect within matter, declare him to be not pure, not simple, not uncompounded, but composed of one thing by means of another. Whereas matter, in itself irrational and without quality, possesses simplicity and the character of a first principle. But God, if indeed he is not incorporeal or immaterial, has thereby partaken of matter as a first principle. For if matter and reason are one and the same, they were wrong to represent matter as irrational. But if they are distinct, then God would be a steward of both, and not a simple but a composite thing, having added to his intelligent nature the corporeal element derived from matter. As for the four bodies, earth, water, air, and fire, which they call the primary elements, I do not know how they make some of them simple and pure, and others composite and mixed. For they say that earth and water are forever, unable to hold either themselves or other things together, but preserve their unity only by a share in pneumatic and fiery power. Whereas air and fire, thanks to their inherent tension, are capable of extending both themselves and other things, and, being blended into those other two, supply them with tension, stability, and substantiality. How then is earth or water still an element, if it is neither simple, nor primary, nor sufficient to itself, but forever in need from outside of that which holds it together in existence and preserves it? For they have not even left us any conception of their substance. Rather, the account, put this way, of some earth in itself, involves great confusion and obscurity. Then again, how can earth, being earth in itself, need air to constitute and hold it together? But in fact, there is no such thing as earth in itself, nor water. Rather, air, by gathering matter together and condensing it in one way, made earth, and by dissolving and softening it again in another way, made water. Neither of these, then, is an element, since something else has furnished both of them with their substance and their coming to be. Further, they say that substance and matter underlie the qualities, this being, more or less, how they render the definition. And yet, in turn, they make the qualities themselves substances and bodies. This involves great confusion. For if the qualities have their own proper substance, in virtue of which they are called, and are bodies, then they have no need of another substance, since they possess their own. But if what underlies them is only this common thing which they call substance and matter, then clearly they merely partake of body, for they are not themselves bodies. And what underlies and receives must necessarily differ from the things it receives and from that in which it underlies. But they see only half of the picture. They call matter without quality. Yet they are no longer willing to call the qualities without matter. And yet, how is it possible to make a body without quality, when they do not conceive of quality without body? For the very argument that binds body to every quality allows the mind to grasp no body except together with some quality. So then, whoever fights against the incorporeality of quality seems bound also to fight against the qualitylessness of matter, or else, by separating the one from the other, to divide both from each other. And the argument some of them put forward, that they call substance without quality, not because it is deprived of every quality, but because it possesses all qualities, is especially contrary to common notion. For no one conceives of without quality as meaning that which possesses no share of quality, nor of unaffected, as meaning that which is by nature always undergoing every affection, nor of unmoved, as meaning that which is movable in every way. And this problem remains unresolved, even if matter is always conceived together with quality, that it is still conceived as something other than, and different from, quality.